Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo and Kelly Jean Kelly. But first, this report.
The idea of free higher education is not a new one in some parts of the world. But the idea has only recently increased in popularity in the United States, as the cost of attending colleges and universities in the country has risen greatly. In the last few years, several states have either launched or proposed programs offering very low to no cost higher education. However, two new studies suggest these programs are failing to serve the people who need them the most, people with little money. Two programs that have recently received the most attention operate in New York and Tennessee. In 2014, Tennessee Governor Bill Haslam created the Tennessee Promise Program. This program covers tuition costs for anyone in the state who wants to attend one of Tennessee's two-year community colleges. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo announced the creation of a similar program in his state, called the Excelsior Scholarship, in 2017. It aims to cover the tuition at public institutions for residents whose yearly household income is below a given amount. That amount started at $100,000 in 2017. In 2019, New Yorkers with yearly household incomes below $125,000 can apply for the program. Yet recent reports from two higher education research groups show serious problems with the design of such programs. Researchers with the Institute for Higher Education Policy centered their study on the New York and Tennessee programs. The two programs are both need-based forms of financial aid. That means the less money students have, the more money they get. But the Institute's study found that the two programs share a quality, researchers say, harms low-income students. The programs are both designed to be forms of financial aid known as last dollar.
Last dollar programs cover the remaining tuition costs students face after they have paid what they can or made use of any other forms of financial aid. But last dollar programs do not consider the difference in need between students of different income levels, says Mamie Voigt. She is the Vice President of Policy Research at the Institute for Higher Education Policy. Voigt notes that many low-income college students in the U.S. make use of other need-based aid programs, like the Federal Pell Grant Program. And New York and Tennessee's last dollar programs do not separate the amount of other aid a student is receiving from the money they already have. So, low-income New Yorkers or Tennesseans may appear to have more money than they actually do when they seek additional assistance from their state, Voigt says. And a wealthier student will get more aid because they appear to have greater remaining costs. For example, Voigt's study found that before the Tennessee Promise program launched, the state's lowest income students had, on average, over $7,000 in unmet need. And since the program's launch, that need has still not been met. Meanwhile, students with more money have been receiving, on average, about $1,500 from the program. Voigt says the problem is that poorer students have to use the Pell Grants and other first dollar aid to cover just the costs of tuition. But fees and additional costs to higher education are not included in tuition. And the small amounts of aid the Tennessee Promise program gives to low-income students do little to help cover those expenses. They still need to pay for things like books and supplies, housing and food, Voigt told VOA. And these free college programs, at least in Tennessee and New York, don't do anything to support low-income students in paying for those other college costs. Voigt would like to see these programs become first-dollar aid. This means the states would cover as much of the tuition as students need based on their actual income level. Then, low-income students could use federal and other forms of aid to cover the extra costs.
However, Mike Krause argues it is unreasonable to expect states to change in the way Voigt suggests they should. Krause is the executive director of the Tennessee Higher Education Committee. He notes states such as his have limited financial resources and cannot offer the amounts of money federal and other aid programs can. Yet, that does not mean the programs do not serve a greater purpose. He says that for years, many Tennesseans have not seen higher education as a possibility because of the high costs. But once the message of free college began to spread in the state, many people began reconsidering this belief, even if some costs are still involved. States have to operate within reality, Krause said. So to just tell every single student you have a full scholarship tomorrow probably isn't possible. But if we get into, in Tennessee, college is free, except for in the following circumstances, the risk there is that you water down the message to students. The results of the Tennessee Promise Program's message are clear, says Krause. The state reports that its rate of students entering into higher education has increased by almost 10% since the program started. Also, Krause notes that the Tennessee Promise Program offers aid only for tuition at community colleges, which higher-income students usually do not attend. And 8,000 of the Tennesseans who began studying in the time the program has been operating received Pell Grants. This suggests that students with financial need are entering into higher education. Still, the problem is not limited to how much financial assistance these programs are providing, says Katie Berger. She is a policy expert with the research group The Education Trust, which released its own study of 31 free college programs and proposals. The study measured how well each of the 31 programs and proposals served low-income students based on 8 different qualities. The study's findings showed that the programs and proposals made the ways in which students received their benefits needlessly complex or limiting.
For example, By limiting the program to community colleges, the Tennessee Promise program limits the choices available to students. And community colleges do not always have the same supports and resources available for students as four-year schools, Berger says. Another quality the Education Trust looked at was whether the aid these programs offer would be considered a loan that students had to repay. This is the case for students receiving New York's Excelsior Scholarship if they leave the state within 2 to 4 years of completing their studies. Berger notes special rules like these do not consider the needs of low-income students first. So, she says, the free college programs are working against themselves. A free college program can serve as a powerful messaging tool, telling students that college is available to you, she said. However, the benefit of telling a low-income student that they can afford college is undercut if you don't actually make it affordable. Yet Don Kaplan, who represents the office of New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, says these studies are oversimplifying the issue. For one thing, he says, from the beginning, New York considered the Excelsior Scholarship a program to serve middle-income students. And the studies do not consider the aid programs the state has specially designed for poorer students. In fact, New York's Tuition Assistance Program provides about $1 billion in need-based aid directly to the state's lowest-income students, Kaplan reports. They attempt to analyze one program without understanding how it interacts with the rest of the state's free tuition financial aid system, he wrote in a statement. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Now, the VOA Learning English Program, Words and Their Stories. On this program, we explore words and expressions in the English language. We also explain how they developed and how English speakers use them today. We try really hard to make this program special, but not everything can be special all the time. In fact, many things are just average or normal. Today, we talk about an expression often used to describe such things, run of the mill. So why do we use this expression to mean not so special? To explain the meaning of run of the mill, let's talk about the word mill. A mill is a place where machines make products. It is like a factory. For example, a paper mill makes paper, and a steel mill manufactures steel. A mill can produce just about anything. While mills make many kinds of products, language experts are not exactly sure which type of mill is being described in the expression run-of-the-mill. One possible explanation begins in a clothing mill. Many years ago, all clothes were made by hand. Handmade clothes took a lot of time to make, and they were generally one of a kind. None of them looked exactly the same. However, as technology improved, machines began making most clothing. By the early 1900s, the expression run of the mill described machine-made clothes. Such clothing was thought to be less special than handmade products. Now, another story simply suggests that when mills were producing products, quality control was a problem. A mill would simply make a lot of a product, without much thought of quality. You could say it was a quantity over quality way of thinking. The more, the better. Language experts note that by the early 1920s, people began using run-of-the-mill to describe anything thought to be ordinary or commonplace. Today, that meaning is unchanged. Anything that is a typical example of something, we can call run-of-the-mill. And this expression is widely used today. If you go to a show and the singer is just so-so, you could say it was a run-of-the-mill performance. Perhaps you bought a run-of-the-mill computer. You know, a model that you can find anywhere. Maybe you have a friend who moves to a run-of-the-mill town, lives in a run-of-the-mill apartment, and works a run-of-the-mill job. Nothing about his new life seems very special. Hopefully, he will make some new friends or start a new activity to make his day-to-day life more interesting. We have a few other expressions that have a similar meaning to run-of-the-mill. One comes from the world of food. If something is cookie cutter, it is just like everything else. This comes from actual cookie cutters, the tools for cutting cookie dough into shapes. All the cookies come out looking the same. The word cookie cutter is used to describe a group of things that look alike. For example, if a land developer develops a neighborhood using the same design for all of the houses, they may look very cookie cutter, or all the same. Another expression comes from a favorite activity of many people, gardening. If something is described as a garden variety, it is average, common, or mediocre. This comes from the fact that some things grow very easily, and some fruits, vegetables, flowers, or plants that grow easily become popular with gardeners. They are varieties that are found in many gardens. So we call them garden varieties. Now let's hear how we can use some of these words and expressions.
You must try a piece of this bread.
Wow, this is really good. Where did you get it?
It's a new place down on Waterfront Street. From the outside, it looks like your average run-of-the-mill bakery. But as soon as you enter the store, you know it's not. They handcraft all of their breads and pastries. Nothing cookie cutter about this place.
Cookie cutter. Get it?
Yeah, that's funny.
So, what's the name of this unique bakery? I have to go.
It's not your run-of-the-mill bakery.
Yeah, I understand. But what's the name?
It's not your run-of-the-mill bakery.
I get it.
No, you don't. That is the name of the bakery.
Oh, sorry.
One last note. You can use all of these expressions, cookie cutter, garden variety, and run-of-the-mill, in any situation, with people you know well or not at all. And that's Words and Their Stories for this week. I'm Anna Mateo. Just an ordinary song.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Franklin Pierce, the 14th President of the United States. He took office in 1853 at age 48. At that time, he was the youngest person elected to the White House. Pierce was known for being social and for his good looks. But his personal life was full of tragedy, and he was not an effective chief executive. Over time, he has come to be remembered as one of the country's worst presidents. Franklin Pierce was born in the northern state of New Hampshire. He was one of eight children. He attended school regularly as a child, and he went on to Bowdoin College in Maine. There, he developed his skills as an excellent public speaker. He also became an able lawyer. Pierce's abilities carried him far, but his personal connections helped too. His father became the governor of New Hampshire. Shortly after, Pierce was elected to the state legislature. He soon became a member of the U.S. Congress, first as a member of the House of Representatives, and then as a senator. Several important things happened in Pierce's personal life during those years in Washington, D.C. He married Jane Means Appleton. They soon had a son, but the child died after only 3 days. The couple went on to have two more boys. In Washington, Franklin Pierce also developed friendships with many people from the South. They defended the right of states to permit slavery. Although he was from the North, Pierce came to share the opinions of his Southern friends. He grew to dislike anti-slavery activists, who were known as abolitionists. As a politician, Pierce was a member of the Democratic Party and strongly supported the ideas of President Andrew Jackson. But politics did not appeal to his wife. She also did not like her husband's habit of drinking alcohol with his friends. Jane Pierce belonged to the temperance movement, which urged Americans to avoid the use of alcoholic drinks. So Pierce resigned his job in the Senate and moved back to New Hampshire. There, he stopped drinking alcohol and earned fame as a lawyer and public speaker. But tragedy struck again. His second son became sick and died. Pierce remained active in politics in New Hampshire. He helped the Democratic candidate for president at the time, James K. Polk, win votes in the state. When Polk entered the White House, he gave Pierce a position as a general in the Mexican-American War. Pierce did not earn the respect of his troops. In one battle, he passed out after he fell off his horse and crushed his leg. Some of his men, seeing what happened, fled the battlefield. Others called him Fainting Frank. Although Pierce had his critics, he returned to New Hampshire as a leader in the state's Democratic Party. Yet no one expected him to become President of the United States. Pierce's nomination came during the Democratic National Convention in 1852. Party leaders could not agree on a candidate. They were split among the three top choices. So the party turned to Pierce. They liked the fact that he was not well known or had taken any strong positions as a lawmaker. As a result, fewer people could object to him, they reasoned. Pierce did very little during the election campaign. He did not need to. Many voters, especially in the South, did not like his opponent. When the election was held, Pierce won easily. But before he took office, another terrible thing happened. Franklin and Jane Pierce were traveling by train with their youngest son, Benjamin, who was 11 years old. The train went off the rails. Benny was killed instantly in front of his parents. Neither Franklin nor Jane Pierce ever really recovered. Jane believed their son's death was a punishment from God for her husband becoming president. As president, Pierce faced an extremely difficult situation. The country's ongoing dispute about whether and where to permit slavery was becoming more intense. Under Pierce, the dispute centered on the areas of Kansas and Nebraska. At the time, both areas were considered territories, not states. And each territory was above the line of the Missouri Compromise of 1820. That act, approved by lawmakers nearly 35 years before Pierce took office, banned slavery in northern areas, including what would become Kansas and Nebraska. But pro-slavery settlers demanded that Kansas and Nebraska voters, a group comprised of white men, decide the issue for themselves. A majority of U.S. lawmakers agreed. Under pressure, President Pierce signed the Kansas-Nebraska Act in 1854. The measure was one of the most important in U.S. history. It overturned the Missouri Compromise and canceled the ban on slavery. It incited years of intense violence between pro-slavery and anti-slavery activists, and it pushed a divided nation even further apart. The Troubles also showed Pierce to be an ineffective president. He could not ease the tensions over slavery nor unite the country behind the Kansas-Nebraska Act. And he delayed using his power to stop the violence in Kansas until it was far too late. Finally, his sympathy for pro-slavery groups angered many in the North, including people in his own party. The Democrats did not nominate him again at the next election. After 4 years as president, Pierce returned to New Hampshire. He rarely socialized and began drinking alcohol again. After his wife died in 1863, Pierce seemed to disappear from public life. Americans heard little about him until his death in 1869. But he lived to see the ultimate tragedy of the Civil War, that he, like other presidents before him, had failed to prevent. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.